From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The mass shooting, school shooting, this time in Roseburg, Oregon, comes at a highly political time, the thick of the 2016 presidential campaign, and at a time when maybe the American political chemistry on guns is changing. Maybe. President Obama is not shying away from gun politics. He's calling for this to be political. Presidential contenders on the spot are all over the map. Americans are sick of the mass shootings of gun violence, so what? This hour on Point, guns, gun policy, and the 2016 campaign. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the way here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will hear from Republican Congressman from Florida, Daniel Webster, a favorite of the right-wing Freedom Caucus, on the battle to succeed John Boehner as Speaker of the House and his own, Webster's, hat in that ring. But first, to the politics of guns and gun policy. Different sounds out of the two major parties over the last week. And within the parties as well. Here was Donald Trump at an event, campaign event in Franklin, Tennessee on Saturday, saying the deadly shooting wouldn't be so tragic if teachers had been armed.
Every time something happens, they blame. They don't blame mental illness, that our mental health care is out of whack, and all of the other problems. And by the way, it was a gun-free zone. I will tell you, if you had a couple of the teachers or somebody with guns in that room, you would have been a hell of a lot better off. You would have been a hell of a lot better off.
That's what Donald Trump's got, a couple of teachers with guns in that room in addition to the gunman. At Broward College in Florida on Friday, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton spoke passionately against gun violence and the obstacles to doing something.
It is just heartbreaking. It is sickening to me to see another massacre. People should not have to be afraid to go to college like this one, or go to the movie theater, or go to Bible study. What is wrong with us that we can't stand up to the NRA and the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers they represent?
And she's laying out plans to tighten up. Joining us now from New York, Sam Frizzell. He covers politics and the 2016 Democrats running for president for Time magazine. Sam Frizzell, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is Ed O'Keefe. He covers the 2016 presidential campaign with a focus on Jeb Bush and Republicans for The Washington Post. Ed O'Keefe, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Ed, can you take us across the horizon of Republican candidates, their response to the Oregon shootings, and what they're saying on the policy front?
Sure. Let's start with the basics. Basically, all of them that have been in elected office have some kind of an A rating from the National Rifle Association, whether it's Jeb Bush and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, plus Florida or Texas Senator Ted Cruz. But Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham have received A grades. Carly Fiorina has a qualified A rating. She doesn't have a legislative record, but has been on the record as a political candidate in the past supporting gun rights. And there's no rating yet for Donald Trump and Ben Carson. You played Donald Trump's response there, the idea that people in schools, working in schools, should be armed. That is an increasingly popular position among some gun rights supporters. And that was actually something that was first advanced after the Sandy Hook shootings a few years ago.
By the NRA leader.
Exactly. But generally, you've seen the Republican candidates for president at least say that, you know, there is very little actual gun control legislation that would help in any of these situations. And if you look at the situation in Oregon, the shooter bought the guns legally. There was no history in his past that would suggest he was unqualified to buy them. So they point to that and say you've got to focus instead on getting mental health treatment for people who need it, or simple things like making sure parents have time with their children, quality time with their children, that will helpfully, or hopefully, they say, reduce incidents of violence and sort of remind children that that those types of things, owning guns or being around violent people, are unnecessary.
Here's Ben Carson talking about mental health, I guess, but not in favor of gun control.
You're not going to handle it with more gun control, because gun control only works for normal law-abiding citizens. Doesn't work for crazies.
So, Ed, if the emphasis in the GOP has been on the mental health side of this, we know that a lot of mental health government programs have been dismantled over the last few decades. Are there policy changes being recommended to respond to this drumbeat of gun violence and mass killing, school shootings on the mental health front, or just talk about mental health?
Mostly talk. There have been some proposals in the past few years. There were some proposals back in 2013 when this was being debated on Capitol Hill that would have expanded federal mental health programs. They had bipartisan support, but they did not advance. You've heard the presidential candidates talk about the need to focus more on that, but none of them yet to date have presented anything really substantive or realistic, frankly, that would get a chance to move forward on Capitol Hill either. So, you know, there's certainly plenty of talk about it, but very few examples of it actually translating into legislation. The background check expansion that had passed, or sorry, that was proposed in the Senate back in 2013 but failed to advance.
After Sandy Hook, yeah.
Did include some mental health provisions, but again, didn't go anywhere, and there hasn't been any serious movement on that issue, on guns, of course, since that vote failed.
And then I want to, Sam, I'll definitely come to you. There's a lot on the Democratic side of the ledger, but I have to ask about Jeb Bush and his "stuff happens" remark. It's been repeated all over the place. President Obama picked it up. It's gotten a lot of criticism for the Florida former governor. He says it wasn't about this in particular, but it sure sounded that way as it came out. Here he was in Greenville, South Carolina on Friday at a gathering there where they had been talking about the shootings in Oregon. Here's Jeb Bush.
We're in a difficult time in our country, and I don't think more government is necessarily the answer to this. I think we need to reconnect ourselves with everybody else. It's just it's very sad to see. But I resist the notion, and I had this challenge as governor because we had, look, stuff happens. There's always a crisis. And the impulse is always to do something, and it's not necessarily the right thing to do.
Ed O'Keefe, stuff happens. It can sound like a very callous response to Roseburg, Oregon. And yet he's not the only one. Donald Trump said something similar, not quite as succinctly and quotably. But what is Jeb Bush talking about there? What's he trying to get across?
Well, first of all, a few things. And I think those of us in the media probably should have taken a little more of a half breath before we confronted the president with this, for example, because at the time that the president was asked about this, there was still some very partial reporting on the full statement that Bush had made. But the bottom line is, yes, he said this, that essentially what he said is things happen all the time, whether it's gun violence, whether it's something else. The instinct of people is to find a government response. His argument is that isn't always necessary. He used another interesting example where he suggested that, you know, if you pass laws in states requiring people to put fences around their pools, there's still children who are going to drown in pools because they're able to get beyond that fence. What's notable about that is that he actually had passed or signed legislation doing just that, requiring fences around pools, and then children in Florida died. And it was in response to the fact that some children had died falling into pools. So it is seen certainly by Democrats, by his critics, as a callous remark, as a sort of dismissive stance on this issue. But his broader point is one that I think many Republicans agree with, which is government isn't always going to have the solution to this, and the knee-jerk response of people to do something isn't necessarily one that's going to work. He has said this. I think we've seen Marco Rubio and others say it in different ways. The fact that he used the phrase "stuff happens," though, of course, was seized upon by critics, by gun control advocates. And frankly, in a broader sense, it's another example of yet another verbal cul-de-sac that Jeb Bush has found himself in and often has to explain himself out of.
Ed O'Keefe, stand by on the GOP side of all the gun debate. Sam Frizzell in New York with Time Magazine. Coming on the Democrat side, they've been anything but "stuff happens" in their response to Roseburg, Oregon. Give us a sense of the span of Democratic rhetoric and hard proposals in the last week, Sam.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one of the things you're seeing on the Democratic side is much stronger rhetoric about gun control than we've seen in previous election cycles. I think Democrats have come to the point post Sandy of taking a stronger stance on these issues because I think they fear repercussions from the NRA less than they did before. If you look at Hillary Clinton's comments on Friday, she said she challenged Republicans to look in the eyes of of parents whose children had been killed. She talked about building a national movement to take on the NRA. That kind of language, we haven't heard that in many years in Democratic primaries. So I think you're seeing something new there, and you're seeing relative uniformity between the candidates on this issue. I don't think we're necessarily seeing dramatically new policies being proposed, but we're seeing sort of a new rallying cry that certainly wasn't evident in 2008 in the primary.
It may not be entirely new, though. Hillary Clinton just this week has laid out, I think, four planks of quite firm, if highly controversial, changes that she would make. Here she was in Manchester, New Hampshire yesterday saying it's time to act.
And when this happens, people are quick to say that they offer their thoughts and prayers. That's not enough. How many people have to die before we actually act?
Sam, we're going to dive into what Hillary's actually put on the table, but she also seems a kind of incentive here, perhaps. This is an issue on which Bernie Sanders has had a kind of a mixed record in terms of whether or not he's hardcore gun control.
If you look at what they're actually proposing, though, in most of their proposals are actually in agreement. Both are in favor of a ban on assault weapons. Both are in favor of expanding background checks. The one major area of difference was in their votes in Congress to a 2005 law that essentially gave legal immunity to gun manufacturers. Bernie Sanders voted in favor of giving gun manufacturers sort of legal immunity, and Hillary Clinton voted against it. And so that's something that we can probably expect Hillary Clinton to bring up in the debate next week in Las Vegas, the Democratic primary debate. But other than that, they're pretty much in agreement on how to deal with gun issues.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After the mass killings, school killings in Roseburg, Oregon, we are talking about American gun policy this hour and the 2016 campaign with Sam Frizzell of Time Magazine covering Democrats on the campaign trail, Ed O'Keefe with the Washington Post covering Jeb Bush and Republicans. You can join us this hour. How many more massacres before we change? What is the change we need if a change is needed? What do you think about Stuff Happens as a view broadly on this front? Who on the campaign trail is speaking for you when it comes to guns? Do you want more controls, background checks, tightening? Do you want the focus to be on mental health? What would that mean? And I guess the big question, is this still radioactive politically? Or might this country do something about gun control, gun violence, something effective? The president's headed out to Roseburg to meet with families there. He said last week, this should be political and that all Americans are responsible through our politics and policy.
This is a political choice that we make. To allow this to happen every few months in America. We collectively are answerable to those families who lose their loved ones because of our inaction.
Republicans not really picking up that theme. Here was Carly Fiorina. This was on Friday in South Carolina. Well, here she is.
This campus was a gun-free zone. And yet, somehow, this individual got onto campus with not one gun, but several guns. So before we start calling for more laws, I think we ought to consider why we don't enforce the laws we have.
And Jeb Bush, there at that conservatives meeting in Greenville, South Carolina, really not getting on this anti-gun bandwagon at all. In fact, kind of celebrating here in his remarks just Friday after the Oregon shootings, a pretty cool moment, he called it, with Charlton Heston giving him a gun on stage in front of a lot of people.
In Florida, when I was governor, I was the NRA Statesman of the Year one year. It was on my highlight reel where Charlton Heston gave me a gun on the stage in front of 15,000 people. That was pretty cool, to be honest with you.
So here we are, really different attitudes on the big question of guns and whether there's any policy that can change out of this. Ed O'Keefe, I'm reading here Alec McGillis writing in Politico says, look, the gun lobby's power is overstated today. The chemistry is changing. Yes, it failed after Sandy Hook, but not by that many votes. And those who stood up with the NRA, Democrats who joined them, were not rewarded by the NRA. There is an opening here for change against the sort of wall, impenetrable wall of opposition to change on this front that has been presumed to be there for a long time. What do you think, Ed?
Well, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg tried it. Former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords tried it, and so far they've failed. They ran ads in support of candidates who supported stricter gun laws. Either those candidates lost or those ads had very little significance, and if anything, they drew just more advertising and the ire of the NRA and other gun rights groups. You're right. There are Democrats out there, I think most notably Joe Manchin, the senator of West Virginia, who have strong gun rights records and have had a good reputation through the years with the NRA, but they're likely to face some tougher times with those groups when they come up for re-election. Manchin's up again, I believe it's in 2018, and is going to face, you know, a difficult – no, sorry, next year in 2016. And he's going to face a challenging re-election because he tried to get background check legislation passed. So, yes, there's always an opening for some other group to emerge. There's always a chance for some kind of an organization to step forward and rally the concerns of people. Mothers Against Gun Violence joined with Bloomberg's group after they were founded. I think it was Moms Demand Action Against Gun Violence was the name of the group. It was started by a mother in Indianapolis who was just horrified by what happened at Sandy Hook. They created a grassroots organization. It blossomed into a bigger thing. It has since merged with Bloomberg's group. They said they would be out there, lobbying candidates and holding people to account if they had basically voted in lockstep with the NRA before. Guess what? Most of those people are still in office. So I see Alec's point. He's a very perceptive writer, and there are those out there certainly who believe that at some point something can be done. But until you can convince those that are in control of Congress that they've got to do something more meaningful, until you can convince state legislatures to do that, most of them still controlled by Republicans at this point. Republicans, of course, generally opposed to making changes in gun laws, it's going to be a very difficult and expensive effort.
Of course, Alec McGillis, who wrote that with ProPublica, but it was in the New York Times. I misspoke there. Ed O'Keefe, Democrats sure pushing hard on this, whether on the campaign trail, whether or not it's got whatever its prospects are, ultimately, if it were a Democratic presidency next time. Talk about the dynamics of that. Hillary Clinton's political incentive to go hard here, if one needs an incentive beyond this drumbeat of killings, and of course there's always the sort of constant background killings in the United States, when it's not big numbers, but just in single days, but just on and on and on all over the place.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see. Let's assume in the next 18 months that President Obama finds some other ways to make some changes through executive action. He has asked his administration to find those examples and see what he can do. They will be modest at best, but they will be something. If you have a Democrat elected president in 2016 and takes office in 2017 when Republicans still control Congress, that next Democratic president might try to find some ways to take even further executive action and then propose legislation that probably will go nowhere. Because again, Republicans continue to control Congress. And they are still, you know, firmly on the side of groups like the NRA and those opposed to making changes. And so, you know, it will continue to be at loggerheads, essentially, unless there is some dramatic change in the political dynamics of the country, or in the next 18 months, some other well-funded group emerges and starts holding Republicans to account for continuing to vote against this kind of legislation.
And then there's Senator Bernie Sanders, who, as congressman back in, what was it, 05, voted for the legislation that would protect gun manufacturers from legal liability. On Thursday, he talked with MSNBC's Chris Hayes about gun control, so it's going to take a serious conversation.
You can sit there and say, well, I think we should do this and do that, but you got a whole lot of states in this country where people want virtually no gun control at all. And if we are going to have some success, we are going to have to start talking to each other. And here's what I think is the good news, that I think there is a consensus for serious gun control, including among people who own guns.
Bernie Sanders there last week. Sam Frizzell, Ed O'Keefe, please stand by. I want to bring our callers in and then turn to Daniel Webster at Johns Hopkins. Maria in Iowa City, Iowa. You're on the air, Maria. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Two quick questions. Yeah. We keep leading in with how many more massacres will it take before we make some changes? But what about the gun violence in Chicago, Cleveland, Baltimore? every day I read more than 10 individuals were killed there.
Lots,
My second question is, the common denominator in these mass killings, to me at least, seems to be mental health. So when will we take this mental health issue more seriously? And I'll take your answer off the air.
May I just ask you, does that mean are you opposed to, let's say, universal background checks? Do you want to put all the emphasis on mental health?
Oh, Tom, with the working in the public health field, I really believe this is a mental health issue. I do think that we need stronger background checks, but I think it's a disservice to these individuals who are obviously suffering from mental health issues to not provide them with the care and the service they need. They shouldn't have to live this way and result to this action.
Okay, so I get it. So that would not be just status quo either. That would require some major effort. And yet there's the question of gun availability, even with those who are mentally unstable, let's say. Let me hold that thought for 1 second, Maria. Of course, the big killings get attention because they're so shocking. These are in school classrooms. But the gun death toll nationally and all over the place is big in a constant way as well. Akash is calling from Des Moines. Akash, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Quick point.
Yes.
Where the change is required is, once a individual makes a decision to kill, whether it's mentally stable or unstable is a different question, but mm-hmm. once a person makes a decision to kill, how can we minimize the loss? Can guns contribute to the massacres or knives or, that's where the loss will help?
I mean, it's a lot harder to kill a bunch of people with hammers and knives. Just look at the statistics of murder rates in countries with tougher gun laws. They are far below ours, Akash.
That's correct. So the gun laws will help there. Yes, mental health and all those are there, but gun laws should be there just to get access to the guns. How easy it is for anyone.
Quite easy in this country. Akash, thank you for your call. Ed, Sam, please stand by. Daniel Webster joins us right now, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, professor of health policy at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. Daniel Webster, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Could we just go first to the big picture and whether you see an evolving change in chemistry in the face of all of these shocking gun incidents? That looks to you like it might bleed into real policy change in this country.
Well, I do think that the tragedy at Sandy Hook was a turning point. I think there was an enormous amount of energy that hasn't gone away since then. Our focus today is on what did or didn't happen in Congress following that tragedy. But I'll tell you that roughly half the U.S. population lives in a state that strengthened its gun laws following that tragedy, strengthened it in some sort of meaningful way. Sometimes it was shoring up background checks. Somewhat more commonly was expanding domestic violence gun restrictions. But many states are acting. Now, the 2014 election, of course, changed the political landscape quite substantially, and it's already been discussed on the program that more and more this has become a very partisan issue. It once was the case where you could find moderate Republicans who supported stronger gun laws and conservative Democrats who generally opposed those. Now our parties are on the different ends of the spectrum here. And Democrats have to talk about guns. They have to talk about this issue. And the Republicans now, basically each candidate is mouthing the words from the NRA. That's sort of where we are right now. But the polls tell us, and we just did a poll in 2015, that really things are pretty constant, meaning that both political parties, as far as the population is concerned, want stronger background checks. Both political parties, in terms of their constituents, want measures to keep guns from dangerous people. Now, there's great differences when you bring up the question of assault weapons or concealed carry, but the fundamental issue of the public wanting stronger policies to keep guns from dangerous people, that has been the case for some time and continues to be the case.
And in both parties, but somehow there's a circuit breaker here. We'll look at it. We're talking about gun policy in the 2016 campaign. Ed O'Keefe, if that's the case, if even among Republicans, the polls show support for stronger background checks, does it just break down as simply as the NRA report card and somehow that overwhelms amorphous public sentiment?
That seemed to be what happened in 2013. Remember, the Senate had a pretty broad and bipartisan and meaty proposal to expand background checks as part of that legislation that was introduced in the wake of Sandy Hook. They fell five votes short. They were after a mix of moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans who were from states where it was seen to be okay to do this type of thing. They failed to get guys like Mark Pryor, who was then the Democratic Senator of Arkansas, or Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat from North Dakota. The problem for the Democratic Party is if you seek to take back the control of the House and or the Senate, you have to go into areas of the country that are more rural, that are more moderate, that have a stronger gun culture. And so if you're going to present some kind of legislation in those areas, it's got to be commonsensical. Remember, we had polling at the time. I believe the Post and ABC News did a poll at the time that showed that 9 in 10 Americans supported that bill. But there were just five of them, enough of them, that were going to face intense political pressure back home from the NRA and from other groups that they couldn't do it. They, in some cases, admitted that. Others were in better position. Guys like Mark Kirk, the Republican of Illinois, who's up for re-election this year. Remember that background check bill was co-sponsored by Pat Toomey, Republican yep. Senator of Pennsylvania, who was up for re-election next year. He understood the politics of his state were such that he had to get involved with this kind of thing because while he has an incredibly rural and moderate section of his state, the urban cores in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia were such that they were demanding him to get involved. So, you know, eventually, I suspect something on background checks will happen. You're just going to have to find the right political mix, the right kinds of solutions, and get to a point where the NRA isn't the only voice in this when it comes to special interest groups.
The right mix at the right moment. This drumbeat of killings could make it now. Tanya in Austin, Texas. Tanya, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
I am a U.S. Army veteran. I served in the military for 7 years, most of them overseas. Mm-hmm. So I'm very comfortable with guns, and I've worked with guns a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, however, I'm a high school teacher, and I feel that the idea of arming high school teachers with guns in order to protect our students is absolutely ludicrous.
Donald Trump says if there had been a couple of armed teachers in that room in Oregon, things might have turned out better. What do you say, Tanya?
I think this is an absurd environment for our students to go to school. In fact, I had a student the other day who just mentioned in a conversation, he said, oh, I'm trying to be on good terms with everyone because I don't want to be on anyone's hit list in case somebody comes to school with a gun. And I think this is absurd. How can you go to school having this consideration in mind? They should feel safe. I don't think that the solution is us carrying guns.
Tanya, you're a vet. You're comfortable with guns. You know this country has a lot of guns in it. What would you do? I mean, it's hard to imagine a student having to think in that way. What a shameful thing that American students
exactly.
might have to think that way. But what would you do?
I want to decrease the number of guns in society in general and have a tighter control over who can carry a gun, who can even purchase a gun. Right now, this is so easy. You just go to Walmart and you buy a gun.
So, but you look around you in Texas. Do you think that could have a snowball's chance of passing in your state?
Oh, I think that would be really hard. In fact, when I shared with some of my colleagues the comment and the student made, they thought he was paranoid and he needed to go and get counseling to treat his own issues, quote.
His issues. Wow. I mean, just watch the news. Look around. Tanya, I really appreciate your call from Austin, Texas. Daniel Webster, it is easy for people to despair and think we're never going to get out of this. Hundreds of millions of guns around. What do we? There's nothing to be done.
Sure. So I think one reason why we're sort of stuck in place here and why you see this disconnect between 85% of gun owners supporting expanded background checks and such deep opposition in places like Texas and difficulties of moving forward is that the gun lobby has done a masterful job basically changing the subject or changing the question. The question of background checks comes up, and they say, well, do you think the government should take your guns away from you? Well, of course, that's not what background checks do, but that is the mindset, and they want to continue a cultural battle and keep it on a cultural plane.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking after Roseburg, Oregon, about American gun policy in the 2016 campaign with Ed O'Keefe of The Washington Post, Sam Frizzell of Time Magazine, Daniel Webster at Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. You can join us this hour. How many more massacres before we change? What is the change we need? What is the way out of this American hellhole when it comes to gun death of our own citizens, at the hands of our own citizens? Funnily enough, we're going to talk with another Daniel Webster before this hour is out, the Republican congressman out of Central Florida who is running for Speaker of the House, hard right. His posse was influential in John Boehner leaving, challenged him earlier this year. But first, gun control. Let's go to our listeners, Rich in Block Island, Rhode Island. Rich, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. Reasonable regulation, it's clear, does not violate the Second Amendment. It is also clear to me that the mental health issue, although very significant, is being used as a distraction by the NRA to avoid dealing with regulation of guns. Secondly, there's two ways of bringing about regulation. One is either through raising money enough sufficient to overcome the NRA's amount used for lobbying, or at the ballot to make it clear to the politicians that they'll be defeated unless they go along with regulation. Regulation is something that the public can be convinced is necessary and a practical approach. They have to also be made to realize that this massacre can happen, and I think they're realizing it more and more, in their own backyard at any time, any place, unpredictably.
Yeah.
It is a great threat. So if we can raise the money or have an organization to get that across, I think we can do something about it.
Rich, I appreciate your call. Daniel Webster, we have two great political reporters here with us, but I'm going to have the temerity to bring the money politics of this to you. The NRA is laser-focused on opposition here, and they've got plenty of big money behind them. How you must have thought about this a lot, though, because this is maybe the central issue in political change on this front. How does sufficient focused energy and money, Rich says, calling in, ever get focused on this to counteract the laser focus of the NRA on American policy?
Right. So, look, money always helps in politics. However, I actually don't think that's the principal barrier here. I think the principal barrier is that people who want to defeat stronger gun measures like background checks have a very, very committed core single-issue voter group who they know they can count on. That has not been the case when it comes to the very large majority who want stronger gun laws, but that is not their passion. That is not the single issue in which they cast their vote. So I think that has been the missing ingredient. And I think, again, the other missing piece here is the challenge is to change this from a cultural debate to a public safety debate. If we keep it on the plane of do you like guns or you don't like guns or and that kind of thing, we will get nowhere, because really the support for strengthening the laws extend across these cultural boundaries, and it's just when you change the subject to questions like people who were shot in Oregon been better off if the instructor had a gun or something like that, that's a ridiculous idea, I think, and I agree with Tanya's point earlier, but really the fundamental question about lowering gun violence in the United States isn't, you know, should we arm teachers or not? It's really, should we enact these basic policies that keep guns out of the hands of the most dangerous? And everything else is the distraction. And distraction plays to the status quo.
Let me ask you this. There are already hundreds of millions of guns out there in this country. So you've got people who say, what's the point? Whatever you do, we're in an ocean of guns. Therefore, we're doomed to gun violence.
Well, I understand that sentiment, but it doesn't line up with what we found in our research. I'll give you a couple quick examples. Missouri is a state in which there's a strong gun culture, yet for many decades they had pretty strong measures to keep handguns out of the hands of dangerous people. They had comprehensive background checks for all transfers with a permitting system for purchasers. However, they repealed that law in 2007. There was an immediate 25% increase in gun homicides in that state when surrounding areas were having the opposite trend, where gun homicides were going down. Conversely, when Connecticut adopted a similar kind of policy with background checks with licensing of purchasers back in 1995, we estimated a 40% reduction in gun homicides. It did take some time. It didn't happen immediately because, yes, there are guns available.
But those are big numbers both ways. At the margins, that's a pretty significant indicator. Our time grows so short. I want to get one more caller, Tony in Detroit. Tony, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to let you know I'm a member of the NRA, and there's so many gun laws on the books now. I don't know if any of your callers that called in about wanting more laws, but go down and see what you have to do to buy a handgun. You have to get fingerprinted. You have to have background checks. Now, maybe they can do something about the mental health issue about these people,
What would you do, Tony? People are sick of seeing Americans gunned down in the streets, in church, in school. What would you do?
Contrary to the other callers, I would have people armed in those places.
You think it'd make us safer if everybody had a gun on their hip like the Old West?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be safer because I think it could stop some of the carnage, yes.
Tony, I appreciate your call. Our time is so short here. Sam, as we head into the heart of the 2016 campaign, how do you think this is going to play out? Does this stay hot and alive? Does it get shunted to the side? Is this effective ultimately for a Democrat running against a Republican? Or is this a hobby, is this an issue that Republicans are going to want to ride to rally?
I think part of the reason you're seeing Democrats talk about it a lot now is that they're still in the primary, and this is the kind of issue that plays well with the Democratic base. But I do think that this year you're probably going to see Democrats talk a lot about it in the general election and more than in previous elections. You think back to 2004 when John Kerry did a photo op essentially of him hunting. It was an issue that Al Gore largely avoided in 2000. And I think after sort of this series of mass shootings that we've had since Obama has taken office, I think that it's an issue that Democrats are unlikely to avoid in the general election.
Does it hurt or help in Bernie versus Hillary? Who's up on the energy of this American outrage or upset over all the killing?
I think that if you talk to Hillary supporters, they will tell you that gun control is an issue that they have an advantage over Bernie Sanders on. But Bernie Sanders also has a D-minus rating from the NRA. And I think that he has fairly strong gun proposals about tackling gun control. And it's important to note that he does also come from sort of a pro-hunting state of Vermont, where he, in the past, has been appealing to constituents who largely have guns.
Well, we will watch this space and hope there's not more fuel of massacre thrown on it. But if the rhythm of the last couple of years is any measure, the possibility of that is only too significant. And Americans thinking about this
challenge and what they're going to do with their vote, their power as citizens to try and effect it. I want to thank all three of you for helping us look at this today. Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research in Baltimore. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Thanks.
Ed O'Keefe at the Washington Post, covering Jeb Bush and Republicans there. Thank you, Ed, for your time.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
And Sam Frizzell at Time Magazine on the Democratic campaign trail. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you so much. Great to be on.
In a moment, he's running to replace U.S. House Speaker John Boehner. We'll hear from Florida Republican Congressman Daniel Webster. This is On Point. Of the three Republican congressmen running to become Speaker of the House, Representative Daniel Webster of Florida is known as a favorite of the arch-conservative Freedom Caucus. In January this year, he mounted an unsuccessful bid to oust Boehner, ran himself against the Speaker. Now his backers are credited with helping drive Boehner out, and Webster is in the running again, along with Kevin McCarthy of California, Jason Chaffetz of Utah. Joining me now from his home in Winter Garden, Florida, is Congressman Daniel Webster. Congressman, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be on, Tom.
Can you just remind us of what's coming up this week procedurally in Congress that will begin to decide the next Speaker of the House? What happens on Thursday?
Thursday, there is a vote of the Republican Conference, and there'll be, I assume, three candidates, maybe more, and those will be each have an opportunity to be nominated and seconded, and then the conference will vote.
Will you be nominated and seconded?
I will.
You're in there with Chaffetz and Kevin McCarthy. Many people are looking to your backers and giving them credit for helping John Boehner decide to go. You ran against him in January. You clearly wanted him out as Speaker of the House. Do you take credit for him going, Congressman?
No, my battle is more, is not with personalities. My battle is with the way the Congress operates. And right now, I would term the way we operate as power-based, in that a few people at the top of a pyramid of power are the ones that are controlling the agenda and all that goes on, as opposed to a principled-based, which would say that every member's idea should be heard. So you push down the pyramid of power, spread out the base so every member could be heard, and you take up the most important issues first, not last, not bumping against some deadline. And that's what I did in Florida when I was Speaker of the House there. We changed a power-based system into a principled-based system.
If your approach had been in effect in these last years when Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and, of course, the House, what do you think might have emerged as legislation, as policy, that has not under did not under Boehner?
We would have had a transportation reauthorization, and we would have had 12 appropriation bills. And that's what I had set up all along. The most important bill we pass is the appropriation bill. We've got to do that. We have to do it every year.
But you don't. Congress hasn't for a long time.
I know, and I plan on doing it. I had a 100-day plan by which we would get through every single appropriation. I know people get afraid of this amendment and that amendment and other things. No, we press on, and we do it. If we get it done, it puts all the pressure down on the Senate. But if you wait till the last minute and you look at your watch and say, whoops, I guess it's another day, we're going to have to do a
continuing resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then and people can say, well, you're going to shut down government, whatever. That wouldn't even be a question if we had done it 5 months ago. We would have done our work. We would have completed our work. Same with reauthorizations. We have a 10-month authorization, CR, and then we get to the 10 months, and they go, well, right at the last minute, I don't think we're going to be able to get it done, so we'll do 2 more months, and we'll do 2 more months, and then we'll do 5 months. You know, that is ridiculous.
If I may ask, Congressman, I mean, you're widely described as a very long shot for the speakership, but you've already had sort of swing weight in the conversation. But let's say you were. Let's say the dark horse comes and wins. Would you shut down government over Planned Parenthood funding?
No, the point is we need to clear those things out way early. We need to be discussing these things so it's not when you run up against the government shutdown, we wouldn't even be there. That's not my the plan is to get those things done so we can discuss everything and send it to the Senate. Then if we got all 12 bills to the Senate, the pressure is on them to either pass something, pass ours, amend ours, send us their position, conference, something.
Flip it around, turn it around, put the onus on Democrats, you say. Kevin McCarthy has been high in that leadership that you haven't been so happy, the leadership you haven't been happy with. He was seen as kind of the presumed successor to John Boehner. But then there was this interview with Sean Hannity last Tuesday, California congressman, suggesting that the taxpayer-funded committee to investigate the terror attack in Benghazi had been designed to harm the political fortunes of Hillary Clinton. Here's that exchange.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee, a select committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping. Why? Because she's untrustable. But no one would have known any of that had happened had we not thought.
Congressman Daniel Webster of Florida, does that exchange indicate to you that Kevin McCarthy's not got the savvy to be House Speaker?
Well, I am saddened by what was said. However, my disagreement is not with that. My disagreement is with the way the House operates. That, to me, is the number one problem that we have. And because of that, our numbers in January were about 11% favorability, and just one of the polls here, the last one on our favorabilities was done Friday, and it was still at 11%. We can improve that. I did in Florida. We changed our whole system to what I'm talking about, taking about the most important bills first, not meeting at night, not meeting after midnight on the last day of session.
And I guess your point is that this would permit the majority, Republican majority, to ultimately have more sway over outcomes in Congress.
Well, no, it would allow the rank-and-file members to participate. That's the problem right now, is that if you push down the pyramid of power, then every member has an opportunity to participate, because we're not limiting debate, we're not cutting off amendments, we're not running bills and closing bills so that nobody can offer anything to improve it. All of those things go out the door.
Congressman, you're very politically savvy. I mean, you're a realist. How do you see this turning out? Who do you see as the next speaker? McCarthy? Chaffetz? Jason Chaffetz?
Well, I'm not going to condemn myself. I'm going to give myself a real good shot.
We'll give you a shot. But if it's not you, what's your best projection?
I think right now things are really in flux, and I don't know who the next speaker is going to be, but we'll see.
If you're forced to vote for one of those two, where does your vote go?
I'm not forced yet, so I'm gonna plot. I'm a plotter, not a planner. To me, I plot along. I'm talking to every member I can. I'm going to go to every single conference caucus that's going to ask for an opportunity to speak. I'm going to sell this message one way or another.
Daniel Webster, Republican congressman out of Central Florida, running for Speaker of the House. Long shot, everybody says, but he's been influential already, favored of the Conservative Freedom Caucus. Congressman Webster, thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. You can continue all this at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.